Bryant Terry is in the business of preserving African-American recipes and the stories that are behind them. He is a noted cookbook author and chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora. Terry is editor and curator of the book Black Food, Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora, which, as the title suggests, is a full sensory experience, not just a bunch of recipes. I got a chance to speak to Bryant Terry about the book last November. Now, it's hard to find a word to describe this project. You call it a communal shrine to the shared culinary histories of the African diaspora. So, it's a shrine, it's a set of essays, it's artwork, there's even a Spotify playlist attached to this. What was the creative vision that started all this?
We need to go back to 2015 when I started my role as chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. And Linda Harrison, the former executive director, invited me to co-create this program. She wanted to move the museum beyond just being a fine art museum and really being a space for a community to gather and to help to educate and move people. And so we started this program. The first event we did was Black Women, Food and Power, which you know is one of the chapters in the book. And I expected people to drive up from Los Angeles, or I thought people might even fly in from Portland. But the fact that we had people flying from the East Coast for a two-hour program in our museum just showed me that there was a hunger for this type of programming. And so I thought about doing it in book form. But it was always on the back burner until 2020, when we saw the uprisings. And I decided that this was the time to gift the world with a book that had these diverse voices throughout the African diaspora talking about their various experiences and connection with Black food.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is so much to this project. The chapters are big themes and narratives whose stories are told in the food. So let's look at chapter 2, Migration, and we'll weave in a song you picked for this chapter, All Blues from Miles Davis. Last night I made a recipe from page 87 in this chapter of Migration, the rice pudding flan. Whoa. Flan de arroz con dulce, sticky rice, custardy flan, caramelized sugar. It's a lot of work, but also very smooth and sweet. But I gather the rice in this recipe helps to map the geography and the important history here, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, rice is a through line throughout Black food, and there's a complicated history with people of African descent and rice. We know that many of the enslaved Africans that were bought from the Senegambia region to the New World, they were brought because of their expertise in rice growing. But this recipe, just so you know, this is just such a standout, and you can tell me it is labor intensive. Paola Valles.
Oh my goodness! I mean, there's caramelizing the sugar on one hand, and then there's the rice on the other hand, and then of course making the custard and baking it and then sticking it in the fridge. My goodness!
Was it worth the labor? Did it, what was the payoff for you, Scott?
Oh, it's so worth it. First of all, I mean, it makes so much, and you can only eat a little bit at a time.
It's rich. It's rich.
It's a rich but powerful and sweet experience because, like this history, like this cookbook, there are so many flavors that are combined here.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, and I'm glad you just talked about the kind of multiplicity of offerings to the book, because one thing that I was clear about, when I would go to these national gatherings that were geared towards fixing our broken food system, I felt like there are a lot of educational and class biases in these spaces. And so often the conversation started with the heady intellectual ideas around food, or, you know, immediately talking about the public policies. And it bothered me that the people most impacted by our quote unquote broken food system, whether they're migrant farm laborers or, you know, people living in urban centers that are often described as food deserts, I didn't see these people in the room. And they certainly weren't at the table driving the conversation about how we should be creating change in our food system. Those moments helped me think differently about how we can help people change their habits. And when I think about my own kind of origin story, I like to think that my food justice activism started when I was in high school and I heard the hip hop song Beef, which so brilliantly talks about the violence of factory farming and the impact on animals.
Let us begin now with the cow, the way it gets to your plate and how. The cow doesn't grow fast enough for man, so through his greed he makes a faster plan. He has drugs to make the cow grow quicker. Through the stress, the cow gets sicker. 21 different drugs are pumped into the cow in one big lump.
Storytelling isn't just about like text, it's about recipes, it's about the visual art. You know, I think that there's so many ways that we can help people have this immersive experience and really move them to think about their own habits and attitudes and politics and how they might want to shift them. And I think a recipe can be just as powerful as an heady intellectual essay in doing that.
There is so much about origin stories, especially in this chapter. There's one essay in the migrations chapter that calls food the source code from village to dungeon to canoe to the plantations. Boy, I love this term source code. What does it mean to you?
Food carries history. It carries memory. It connects us with our ancestors, the land from which we've come, whether it's the kind of real or imagined land of our ancestors. And I think that it's important for us to connect with this so that we really know who we are and that we can move towards liberation.
Speaking of liberation, that's the one other chapter I wanted to talk to you about, Land Liberation and Justice, chapter 4 in your cookbook. You chose one song for this section, Herbie Hancock's Watermelon Man. Let's listen to that for a second. Now, the watermelon, of course, can carry a racist stereotype. Why did you pick this song as one of the songs for this section?
I'm glad you brought up the fact that there's a history of racial stereotypes in African Americans. And, you know, I've been aware of this history since I was a child. It was something that my family talked about. As they saw it, watermelon is one of our sacred fruits. You know, it's one of the crops that many enslaved Africans, newly freed Africans, I should say, after emancipation. This was a way that they had financial sustainability. They would sell watermelon to actually provide for their families. And there was the longest time, Scott, where I refused to eat watermelons. And it was because I didn't want to reproduce or buy into these racial stereotypes, and me eating watermelon would, you know, substantiate whatever biases some of my classmates or their families might have had. Me making that choice was what I needed to protect myself at the time, but also getting over that hump and really embracing this. I mean, look, watermelon, if people haven't had fresh from the farm watermelon that's grown in the South, you know, it's just, you can't deny it. It's sweet, it's hydrating, it's one of the most perfect foods, I think, for like a hot summer day. And so Watermelon Man, Herbie Hancock's song, is quietly kind of like, you know, a theme song for me. And it really symbolizes my own ability to grow, and also the importance for me to just live my life without the concern of the white gaze. Like, if I like watermelon, I'm going to eat watermelon, and I don't care what anybody says about it.
Yeah. So. Now, one dish from the liberation chapter that I'm planning to make is okra and shrimp purlieu. It's a dish with Carolina gold rice, garlic, onions, ginger, okra, and shrimp. The recipe says it is a dish of pain, resilience, and celebration. There's a lot to unpack here. But again, there's kind of rice and forced labor, and it's in the liberation section of the book. Why?
Yeah. This is one of the dishes that is a staple of the Gullah Geechee people from which B.J. Dennis, the chef who offered this recipe, those are his people. And, you know, I think that this just goes back to the point that I made earlier about the way in which food can carry these histories of forced migration, of disruption of cultures. But I didn't want that to be the focus of the book. I wanted the book to be about our agency, our brilliance, our magic, you know, what happens when we aren't focused with this albatross of white supremacy. And I think this is one of those dishes that represents that. It's drawing on this history, and it's, you know, rice is obviously such an important staple and contested ingredient in terms of the history in the Carolinas, but just the ingenuity, creativity, using what's on hand, sea animals, which are such an important part of Gullah Geechee cuisine, and then okra, which is, you know, one of the staples from West and Central Africa that we see throughout the diaspora. And so ultimately, I feel like this one dish is full of stories in so many ways. I think represents what I see as this kind of cutting and pasting and reworking and remixing of ingredients and cooking traditions and flavor profiles throughout the Black diaspora that create these dishes. I hope the book would really push people to dig deeply and learn more about like the origins of not just the food, but the people who created it.
Bryant Terry speaking last November about the book Black Food: Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora. And by the way, I did make the shrimp purlieu, which was not as complicated as the flan, both really good. You can find recipes for both at hereandnow.org.